Hey there, everybody. This is your friend in podcasting, Phil Lairness. Though, as always, feel free to call me O Captain, My Captain. This is your Chill Pack Hollywood Hour, brought to you, as always, by the good folks at Empire State Gas. Empire State Gas. Our gas is organically grown and gluten-fortified. Sure, it's more expensive than all other gasolines on the market, but we pass those profits on to our shareholders. Empire State Gas. If you can't find it at ESG, you can probably get along without it. Now, if you've been listening to the last couple shows, and if you haven't, stop what you're doing and go listen to them, because don't kid yourself, they were all kinds of awesome. If you have, you know that we've spent an inordinate amount of time, Dean Haglund and myself, discussing the first three movie adaptations of J.K. Rowling's Harry Potter series. And this started two episodes ago when we were using the Harry Potter movies as a point of comparison when discussing the challenges faced by the creative team behind television's Jonathan Strange and Mr. Norrell in adapting the source material by Susanna Clarke. And at some point, honorary member of the Chill Pack Hollywood Hour team, John Lawler, loyal listener and contributor of the theme song to your Chill Pack Hollywood Hour, as well as the jingle for What We're Reading, he took exception to some of the comments I made about the first two Harry Potter movies, and I'm using the term movies ever so generously. Anyway, we addressed his concerns on last week's show, and he responded, and I thought just before we get started here today, I would give John Lawler the last word.
Hey, Phil. I was just calling to kill some time, walking downtown, and I drank two drinks and didn't eat any food, so I'm a little tips. I got a little tipsiness going on. Just finished up with an acting class today. It was beautiful. I had a good time. I learned a lot. And, yeah, I just wanted to say thanks again for ripping me a new one on the air the other day. I think that was both beautiful and difficult. And anything worth doing is both beautiful and difficult. So even though I'm not doing anything, make sense of that, please. Just put some sense in there at some point. Hope all is well. I just passed a place called Ebenezer Dental. I don't trust a place called Ebenezer Dental. No dental place that has an old man's name in it is ever going to get my business. Because I'm sorry, old men don't typically have good teeth, whether because of age or just their lack of caring for their teeth. I mean, one of the two is going to happen. So, anyway, teeth are stupid. Phil, teeth are stupid. Take that from this. Okay, bye.
Okay, bye yourself, John Lawler. Seriously, though, thanks for the message. Now, come on, music boy. Let's hear a theme song.
And now, your Chill Pack Hollywood Hour with Dean Haglund and Phil Lairness.
Phil, Dean, what will it be today? Now intercontinental, LA to Australia. It's your Chill Pack Hollywood Hour. It's your Chill Pack Hollywood Hour.
How you doing there, Dean Haglund?
Well, I'm very good. Thank you, Phil Ernest. How are you?
I've got no complaints. You know, actually, what I've been doing today, because it is Sunday, of course, here in Los Angeles, California.
Right. And here it's Labor Day.
Is it really?
Not all, yes. It is not a national holiday. Only a few states celebrate Labor Day, not the entire country. So you fly an hour north and everybody's at work. You fly an hour south, everybody's on holiday like they are here. It's hard to figure that out.
Wow. But it is Monday. The point is that it is Monday there. And
yes.
Anyway, among other things here on October 2nd, it's the final day of the Major League Baseball season. And it seems like ordinarily we only talk about sports when there's violence or protest involved. And
right.
I wanted to address today's final day of Major League Baseball because it's a chance to address excellence in broadcasting. Today marked the retirement, and I've been enjoying all day the final broadcast for Voice of the Dodgers and one time Voice of the National Pastime, Vin Scully, who
is finally retiring.
Retiring after 67 years of Dodger broadcasts. And
think of that.
And retiring, I mean, it really was beautiful. It's 80 years to the day, he says, since as a little boy, he picked up a box score in the newspaper the day after Game 2 of the World Series. And that lets you know how time has changed. October 2nd, 80 years ago, was the second game of the World Series, and here we're only finishing the regular season today. But, but 80 years to the day, basically, after he fell in love with the details and the nuances of a baseball box score. And also quite beautiful, the final game he broadcasting was a Giants-Dodgers game. You know, the rivalry he grew up loving as a kid and then would be a part of as a broadcaster for so many years. And I just wanted to salute Vin because, you know, I'm no Dodger fan, certainly, but 67 years and he still had it. Mentally, he had it. Vocally, he had it. It's a strong voice. It is not, if you'll pardon the expression, it's not an old man's voice. And not that old men can't have wonderful, rich, deep voices, strong voices, but we know that, you know, it's hard to maintain an instrument for that long.
Sure.
And it was always strong and soothing and the kind of voice that was perfect to be the voice of the National Pastime. Because when you think about it, he was describing games to generations of baseball fans who were listening to these games on radio. And the pace of a baseball game is one that really not only invites, but demands that the play-by-play announcers, as opposed to the other sports, that the play-by-play announcer of baseball be a storyteller.
Right. Yeah, because you have to paint that picture. You can't just go, oh, strike two. Oh, well.
Well, and you have to fill in those gaps. There's long breaks in the action.
Right.
So we salute the great Vin Scully. And honestly, you know, we, I think, take no small measure of pride, as we ought to, for delivering almost 9.5 years of free weekly podcast entertainment, an hour long show, and this guy doing it every day on the road, 67 years.
Every day on the road, flight—that's a lot of travel too.
Yeah.
I hope he stayed with the same airline and got like air miles that he can now just travel around the world. Just on miles.
Well, and you know as well as I do how much that constant travel can affect one's health and affect one's throat. And I was going to save this for a little bit later in the show, but since what better time to ask you about how you maintain your health when clearly you need an iron lung?
Ah, no, it's just a little tickle in my throat. what this being the beginning of spring here in Australia, there's dust in the air. So
all we are is dust in the air. Okay. We heard from Mark Bennett, our loyal listener, good friend, important colleague, helped shape Truth Is Out There and the long-awaited sequel to The Truth Is Out There. We got an email from him. He sent me a link to, on YouTube, KTEL's 24 Goofy Greats, because, of course, we were celebrating the greatness that was Winnipeg's own KTEL Records.
KTEL Records.
But he also, he has been in the hospital, being very ill after some extensive travel. And so his question was, how is Dean so successful / tolerant flying so much? Now, I don't think he means how do you tolerate all the other people, though maybe.
maybe.
I think what he's looking for when he says, please share tips/ techniques, and does it involve grounding? Though, again, this could all
grounding.
Be... Yeah, exactly. Does it mean grounding the plane? Look, I am refusing to allow this plane to take off. We're grounding this flight until I am better rested.
Exactly.
No, I think he wants some tips, and it's not a bad question. Like, I remember when you were doing just an ungodly amount of travel shortly after moving to Sydney... and when the X-Files was shooting and you were doing conventions on the East Coast and you were doing the U.S. and conventions in New Zealand and you were shooting in Vancouver. So do you have any tips in terms of how far from it seeming to, I don't know, sacrifice your health? Often you seem like it energizes you.
Well, yeah, I mean, I get rest. Well, you got to have the ability to sleep sitting up. I think that's your first and foremost. And not everybody has that ability, you know. So once you get past that, then you can actually get some sleep. And I think that's really important. You know, this last flight I did when I went to Winnipeg, I flew to San Francisco. And remarkably, I spent 14 hours on the flight not eating or drinking anything. I passed on all food being delivered and all drinks, all the drink carts. So I just had a bottle of water that I bought at the airport just before takeoff, and then survived on that for 14 hours.
Yes, you
and landed.
You did stay hydrated. I mean, that's the most...
I did stay hydrated, yeah, absolutely. Because, you know, the air is so dry, and it's pressurized to 8,000 feet, I believe, to the air pressure that you would be if you're on a 8,000-foot mountaintop. So naturally, you dehydrate a little quicker. And unfortunately, that compressor, unbeknownst to me, but you could smell it when it first kicks in, goes through the same compressor that the jet engines go through. So you smell the oil fumes of the compressor. So technically, pilots now are getting some weird disease from breathing oily air. Don't even want to think about it. Anyway, so things to do. Stay hydrated. One, if you can, fast. You know, unless you're in business class, the food's much better there. But if you're in the back, don't eat that stuff. And then I also endeavor to try get my knees, sometimes during the flight, up around my eye level. So that means either sliding in my chair and putting my knees up like you did when you were driving in the back seat of the 1967 Plymouth Fury 3. The seats were perfect so that you could put your knees up and have them dangle there. So that helps... you know, that's a specific childhood memory. I should point that out.
What about getting up and moving around? I've heard that that can be very important to get the circulation, keep the circulation flowing like every hour or something.
Yeah. Well, that's sort of why I keep the knees up. I mean, if you're, that's also somewhat impractical on an overnight flight. If everybody's sleeping and you're in the middle seat or the window seat. So I tend to move just within the seat. As opposed to getting up and moving around, because while walking is fine, there's you know, it's limited to how far you can go, of course, and all that sort of thing. So I do more ankle. I circle my ankles a lot and then bring my knees up. And this also prevents deep vein thrombosis, which apparently could affect you quite severely later on. And this is where the blood stops and starts clotting in your lower limbs and could potentially work its way up to your heart and kill you.
Well, I remember there was a time when you were contemplating working on a book, Yoga for Office Workers.
That's right.
Yoga that people could do while seated at their desks. And it seems like certainly that could lend itself to a degree to air travel.
Absolutely. Of course, you know, they keep putting the seats farther, closer and closer together, the coach. So it's not as simple as it once was, unless you're in premium economy to get a little more leg room. So, so again, I do that by sliding down in my seat so that my legs can come up, just so that the circulation has some gravity flow to it, if that makes sense. So knees up to eye level, and even if that means sticking my foot in where the magazine is, and the air sickness bag, you know, that little pouch in the front there. Sometimes I'll just jam my heel in there and have it as a footrest.
And just your luck, even if you did write the book about yoga in the workplace, such practices would be outlawed by really mean bosses, such as the meanest boss in the world, who we have to remember this week in Celebrity Deaths. But before we play the delightful Celebrity Death sting, let me say that this was brought to my attention by our friend Mark Hirschhorn, who wrote,
"Oh,
gents, while the CEO of the now defunct Tiger Oil, Ed Tiger Mike Davis, was not a Hollywood celebrity and as such likely wouldn't be eligible for notice under your Celebrity Death segment, he was nonetheless legend in the business community, not for his business acumen or financial insights or anything like that. No, it was his memos to his underlings at Tiger Oil that made him universally despised for all who worked for him. And his
wow.
internal memoranda has been sent around the world many times over. And I'm going to share some of these. But Tiger Mike passed away this past weekend. I trust you'll enjoy reading some of his choice morsels, if not to your listeners, then certainly to yourselves. So I will share some of these. But before I do, that was from Mark Hirschhorn. And I got to tell you, you know, he's the host and executive producer of Succotash. The comedy soundcast. He is now branding it as a soundcast. He is trying to move away from what he terms as inappropriate and probably outdated terminology, the
right.
podcast. And I have such a great story about Mark that he shared with me via text. Apparently at the recent PodFest, you know, the podcast festival here in Los Angeles.
Yep.
As he always is, Mark was stationed in the lab, the podcast lab. And T.J. Miller, the hilarious T.J. Miller, star of HBO's Silicon Valley, comes in and relentlessly starts tormenting Mark in the podcast lab.
What?
Mark doesn't know T.J. Miller at all. But he had just written a review of T.J. Miller's appearance on the Improv Nerd podcast with Jimmy Caran. Jimmy Caran?
Uh-huh.
Jimmy Caran. And it had been a nice review because Jimmy's a friend of Mark's and he puts on a good show. So Mark had done a really nice review of the show.
Okay.
And it was one that T.J. Miller himself had retweeted several times.
Okay.
So T.J. Miller comes into the lab, sees the layout that Mark has placed down advertising his show, and yells out, "Succotash? I know Succotash. You're the guy who wrote those horrible things about my friend Jimmy Caran's podcast."
What?
Yeah. And he then, you know, how there's all those podcasters gathered around in the podcast lab doing interviews, usually of other podcasters. And he then, TJ Miller then proceeded to sit and talk with three or four other of these podcasters, each time spending his whole time talking about succotash.
Oh my God.
And then,
just trashing it.
Well, no, not really. But then he gets up, looks at Mark Hirschhorn, and announces, I can't talk to you, succotash, because I have to leave. And he did. It was really funny, and all the other podcasters kind of didn't get the joke, which made it even funnier. So the two things that are great is that TJ Miller was totally in character, in his Silicon Valley character, and secondly, of course, right. he gave Mark's show all this free publicity because people thought that he was mad with him for some reason.
That's a pretty good gag, actually.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
what better way to get everybody to listen to a soundcast than to go, oh, my God.
Well, and the nicest, as Mark said, the nicest compliment was that he recognized the succotash name right out of the box when he walked in, which
right.
meant he'd connected my review to my podcast. And apparently several other people saw the addition of soundcast to the logo and said, oh, you're that guy. And indeed, I can imagine years from now, a typical PodFest conversation that begins something like, you know, one podcaster saying to the other, remember that guy who thought soundcast was a good idea? Whatever happened to him? Anyway,
well, and I agree. You know what? The whole pod thing has got to get lost. I was saying that 8 years ago, if you recall, and I had no better solution than soundcast.
Indeed.
Yeah, well, we'll think of something.
Celebrity deaths.
Anyway, it is time to remember the man that Huffington Post just described as the meanest boss in the world.
So mean.
Well, I mean, this is how he once admonished in memo form his employees after one of them said hi to him in the corridor. He sent out a memo to everyone saying, do not speak to me when you see me. If I want to speak to you, I will do so. I want to save my throat. I don't want to ruin it by saying hello to all you sons of bitches.
Well, no, nothing sends the workplace morale higher than a lovely memo that says don't talk.
Oddly enough, that's how Vin Scully maintained his voice for 67 years. As owner of the Tiger Oil Company, Davis turned nasty inner office memos into an art form. It all began for him in 1959 when he married what the Huffington Post describes as one of the earliest cougars ever. At the age of 28, Davis wed 69-year-old Helen Bonfil. He was a high school dropout, and he was serving as her limo driver until her husband, theater and film director George Somme, died in 1956. And she was the owner of the Denver Post newspaper.
Okay.
When the two divorced in 1971, so I'm going to do a little bit of quick math here, but
right.
I really can't. I mean, so in other words, she's into her 80s, right? So,
yeah.
And he's just hitting middle age. Anyway,
right.
During the divorce, he received what the book Here Lies Colorado describes as, quote, a substantial settlement, which he used to start his oil exploration. So here's just a couple of delightful ones for me to share with you. Here is one he wrote in December of 1977 to everyone in the payroll department on the subject of sick pay.
Okay.
Effective now, employees will be docked for the time they are off sick, unless I authorize you to pay them. This is for Tiger Oil Houston office employees. Edward Mike Davis. So that's
Now that's technically illegal. I mean, you have to offer sick pay as part of a labor relation board issue, isn't it? You can't just do that.
Here's to all employees. This is later in December. This is 3 days before Christmas. And you get this memo. All employees of Tiger Oil Company and Tiger Drilling Company Houston office. Is it something with a Christmas bonus in it, maybe? Wishing everyone a Christmas? It's no. The subject is... This is unbelievable. Well, let me just read the first. I don't want to give it away. So here's the first line. This is to all the employees, remember.
Right.
What the employees of Tiger Oil International Incorporated do is none of your damned business. You work for Tiger Oil Company or Tiger Drilling Company when it comes to employment procedures or anything else. Tiger Oil International is a separate company and wholly run as a separate company. If you are not happy working here, I suggest you get a job somewhere else, but you cannot work for Tiger Oil International without my approval. Any conversation of unhappiness or unrest among my employees pertaining to this will mean immediate termination.
What?
God.
Oh, my God. Merry Christmas, everyone.
P.S. There's a P.S.
Oh, my God.
On days you have to work and you think you should be off, you wear slouchy dress attire. This will not occur in the future. You will wear proper dress attire to work always. Also, all employees should have the proper attitude to coincide with proper dress, especially on those days when you're working that you think you should be off.
Is that Christmas?
I don't know. I don't know, but I love that. On the days you think you shouldn't have off, like Sunday or holidays or whatever.
Right.
Those are
don't
the days...
Show up.
Those are the days you have to dress the best and behave the best.
Holy smokes. So this guy had some anger issues, it sounds like.
I'll give you one final one, and then we'll move on. So everyone needs to look up and read about Tiger Mike Davis and his memos. But January 3rd, 1978, this is to all the secretaries in the company. This is a business office. All correspondence and other things pertaining to this office will be typewritten. Handwriting takes much longer than a typewriter. You're wasting your time, but more importantly, you're wasting my time. If you don't know how to type, you'd better learn.
Wow.
How did the person, I want to know, get hired as a secretary without knowing how to type?
Well, that's A.
Who was that sent to, exactly?
Yeah, all the secretaries. And so but somebody would take shorthand and then retype it, I would think. Is that what he was confusing? These seem very angry and or not very specific.
Do you want to know? Do you want to know what he had to say about on the subject of idle conversation, Dean?
Well, one more.
Idle conversation and gossip in this office among employees will result in immediate termination. Don't talk about other people and other things in this office. Now, this is the line, the all caps line. Do your job and keep your mouth shut! Exclamation mark. Edward Blake Davis.
Wow. Wow. Now, did he die alone? I mean,
I don't know. I don't know. He lived a long time. It seems like he was one of... I mean, so 28 in 56, right?
Yeah.
So that's and, 60 years.
60
so
years
he
later.
Lived almost 90. Too mean to die. One of those guys.
Wow. I have a t-shirt that says that.
I know. And you gave it to my father. And he wears
yes.
it proudly. What in the world? We're halfway, almost halfway through this show. What an odd, bizarre show. We're giving health tips. We're playing.
Right.
We're playing voicemail messages from listeners. We're
love it.
We're talking about mean bosses. I almost want to get into a conversation with you actually about worst jobs we've ever had.
Oh, shall we begin? No.
Well. The question would be, are they show business jobs or worse show? You know, this maybe needs to be a special show we do.
Oh, hell gigs. Yeah, yeah. Because
yeah.
I also had a job trying to sell a freezer of frozen meat over the phone. Cold calling. Random cold calling to Winnipeg. Just going, hi, Perhaps you see the commercial where you get a freezer full of meat. I'm that guy.
Like, all right. Well, I have
got an empty freezer.
I have the story that maybe I've told before, but it's always an old chestnut, especially as we get towards the holidays, of the time that I had to fix some audio in a broadcast on neurosurgery techniques from a theater,
yes.
A broadcast studio where surgery techniques were being demonstrated, and there were a lot of severed human heads in that thing. And the smell of the formaldehyde under the hot TV lights and everything, that's always a chestnut. So maybe we'll save that for some other time.
Yes, that's it. We'll take that one.
Let's bring the room up a little bit with some live events of the week.
The Chilpack Hollywood live event of the week.
I'm so worried that a lot of this show is distorting, so I'm sorry if that's the case, ladies and gentlemen. On the other hand, how much do you pay for the podcast? Listen, Dean, what's been going on with your comedy shows?
Well, there have been plenty, including the beginning again this year of the Cranston Cup. Improv teams from around Sydney all compete to get a trophy of some sort.
Right, you talked about that, but I thought you had... Have you been to a convention or anything? Have you...
No, the convention's next week.
Okay.
That's going to be at AMC in Melbourne. And then last week I was filming the Shakespeare Republic project, a very exciting thing where they take Shakespearean monologues, have famous actors do them on camera, and then create a new narrative where all these monologues sort of tie into each other.
Ooh, and what monologue did you do?
I did Act 1, Scene 1 from Othello, the Iago speech, where we see I am not what I am, that one.
Wow.
Very famous. But yes. So I was Iago.
So Iago. Is the anti-Popeye, who always said I am what I am.
Right. I am not what I am. Yes, exactly. That he's pretending to be Othello's servant while the whole time plotting against him.
So Iago just needed some spinach. I mean, he needed some, or maybe
that's all.
Some kale. Or...
And some moral fiber of some sort.
Oh, but, and what better source of fiber than... Okay. well, great. And what's going on with the Dean Hagland Comedy Theater?
We are now lining up investors, and we meet next week with our business consultant, and we are passed on the one space, but now have three other spaces to look at. So it moves forward and looks like it's going to be happening sometime this year, it looks like.
Exciting. Well, I had a very fun experience of hosting a show that I had talked about in weeks past called An LABC Home Companion. And this was an encore Sunday presentation of the Los Angeles Breakfast Club at the Friendship Auditorium on a Sunday night. And it was both a celebration of all that the Los Angeles Breakfast Club embodies, while also... remembering yesteryear when the Los Angeles Breakfast Club was a fixture on the radio, while at the same time paying tribute to recently retired Garrison Keillor's run on A Prairie Home Companion. And it really, those two things really fit like a glove, as it turned out. And it was a huge success, this show. And so much so that we have a by popular demand one night only reprise of the show that we'll be doing on Sunday, November 13th. I'll let people in the future know how they can get tickets if they're in L.A. But what a show this thing was, Dean, with... I mean, I was on stage during the second act, and I was going, wow, this is a real show. I mean, I didn't say it out loud. I didn't say that out loud. I was thinking it.
Right.
But, you know, there were these incredible dance numbers, and you've got Tucker Smallwood doing blues numbers. And, you know, I mean, it's just Karen Foreman did stand-up that was so brilliant. So anyway, it was this great review show in the style of A Prairie Home Companion, and it was such fun for the audience and for the performers. And it was really interesting because I've encountered out in the world some people who, since then, who were in attendance or who came to the club for the first time on Wednesday because they were so moved and entertained by the show. But I got a compliment paid me that I'd never, the specifics of which I'd never received before, and I got to tell you, it made me smack my palm against my head and say, yeah, this is what I've been striving for all my life. Why couldn't I figure this out?
What?
But this one person specifically said about my hosting, you know, and, you know, there's a phrase that I love, right, that a comic says funny things and a comedian says things funny.
Right.
And that makes me a filmmaker. and so the inclination,
so true.
I mean, that's what I am. Yeah. And so the inclination as a host all of a sudden is, okay, I got to be funny. I got to be funny. I got to tell the jokes. I got to do the, you know, and I scripted routine and material. And so I always have to go through that part of the process first before, and then hopefully have enough time to rehearse it. Before I get through all this, boy, this sounds phony. This is not me. I got to strip all this away. I've got to take all the pressure off of the idea, like in this instance, that I am following in the footsteps of Will Rogers and Jimmy Durante and Red Skelton, who hosted these events in the past for the Breakfast Club. Because after all, nobody's clamoring for those guys anymore anyway.
Right. That's sadly true.
And I have to find the tone that I recognize as, oh, right, this is real. This is me talking to people. This is me hosting. This is me making the audience feel welcome, feel taken care of, feel entertained, but also the other performers feeling the same way, right?
Much like you, yes, it's like a podcast.
Well, so here's the compliment that I get from this gentleman is who has known me a long time but had never seen me do anything like this before. And he said that what is astounding is not how powerful I am in hosting or the presence that I have in hosting, but how I'm exactly as I am when interacting one-on-one with my friends. And you know, it felt really good because I was aware that, you know, the work is always to strip away the artificiality and just to talk to people.
Yeah.
But I wish I could have thought about that, you know, although maybe that's just direction that's easier said than done. Just make it sound like you're talking to people, you know, but you put the camera with the things on the cue cards in front of me or a teleprompter or whatever. And initially the instinct is always, I got to put on a performance.
Right.
Instead of, you know, so that's where the work is. You always got to work it to strip away all that artificiality so that at the end of the day, you're just talking to people.
Yeah. Yeah, that's the goal of a lot of not just performers, but you see that with news announcers and talk show hosts and stuff like that, to not only not bring a persona that's so far outside of your own actual being.
Yeah, and yet it's pretty hard to get, isn't it? I mean,
it is hard
most
to get.
People have failed at being talk show hosts. And I think
this
is a big reason why. Many really talented, funny, interesting, and interested people fail at it. And I think one of the big reasons is they fall into the trap of thinking they have to somehow put on a performance.
Right. That they are not enough, which is, you know, often you do therapy to go and tell you, yes, you are enough. It's okay to be who you are. And realize that is in itself entertaining.
Yeah, yeah. So anyway, that was big fun. I did a couple of interesting art excursions this week that we can consider live events of the week that I wanted to share with you. I got to see, just before it closed, the spectacular Cindy Sherman exhibit, Imitation of Life, at the new Broad Museum in downtown Los Angeles. Were you?
Now, I'm curious. I've not been to the Broad. It opened just like a month after I moved to Sydney. And the few times I've been back, I've been told it's a 2 to 4 hour wait to get into that place. Is that true?
Well, it's free.
Yes, but you still need to.
But you need to wait. Or if you have reserved tickets for the paid exhibit, then you get in right at your reservation time, and then, of course, from there, you can go to the rest of the museum without waiting. So that's the way to do it. But yes, every day there are a lot of people. In fact, when we were approaching, Lily was saying, see these people out here? This is the line every single day all the way around the block. I went, really? These same people? You'd think they'd learn their lesson. But I'm a filmmaker. Anyway,
yes.
It was, I'm not sure if I'm crazy about the Broad, about the building, but I will say the way they exhibited this Cindy Sherman retrospective was terrific. For people who don't know, look her up. Her work as a photographer is incredible, not only as a photographer, but as her own model. She always is her own model.
As an actress, like theoretically.
She's an actress. You hit it exactly on the head. You go through like 10 of these photos and you went, wow, she's an actress. She is embodying the things that she wants to depict in these photos. And her work so often is about how media and movies in particular have shaped our own self-images. And also the concept of the masculine gaze, how... This is some crazy stuff, but about how since movies were always made by men, and even if they weren't directed by men, they were photographed by men, the perspective, even in a quote-unquote feminine piece or a feminist piece, the visual perspective is always that of a man, how a man looks. And of course, it's a visual medium, and the visual is a masculine sense versus other senses, listening, for example, that are more feminine senses. And so how there's this gender politics involved, and I can't wait to talk to our friend Alana Rain about this, who not only is a filmmaker and a feminist, but also a photographer. How do you create an entirely different visual language and therefore perspective? How do you do it?
How do you do that? Because that language has to be at least spoken by one other person, the viewer. So I could create a new visual language, but if no one can perceive that language, it becomes mute, basically. Then I've failed at creating a language, and then I haven't been able to communicate any of my ideas in this new visual format.
Cindy Sherman's most recent work, she's still at it, and her most recent work is some of my favorite that she's done. So I encourage everybody, Cindy Sherman, the photographer, check it out. And you really want to see the actual photos in their full-size enlargements.
How long does that show run till?
It closed. 48 minutes ago. It closed after being there for... since the thing opened, at the end of last year. So that would be that. I also took the opportunity, as one does, on the 45th anniversary of the opening of Walt Disney World, I went and took a tour of Forest Lawn Glendale.
Oh,
what's the connection?
The old cemetery.
You say? Well, one of the things is that Walt Disney is buried there in a lovely garden, and it was very touching to see the notes that have been left for him, notes of gratitude from people. But of course, Forest Lawn Glendale was a huge influence on Walt Disney, and at the museum in Forest Lawn is a fantastic free. It's always free. Everything in Forest Lawn is free. And you would say, well, it's a cemetery. Why wouldn't it be free? Actually, in Los Angeles, we can testify to this. A lot of cemeteries trying to make money off stuff.
Yes, forever Hollywood.
But the idea behind Forest Lawn was that it be a place where people can come as like a park, as an art park, where artists can sketch and can learn and can study, where lovers can stroll hand in hand and contemplate what goes past life. Because as one display there. Near Mary Pickford's grave, which you can't see unless you do what I did, which is climb up on a wall and take a photo of it, which I did for you.
Thank you.
But it's a garden wall, and there's a door in it, and there engraved above it is "Death is but a doorway in a garden," And so this is kind of the attitude that Forest Lawn Glendale embodies to inspire thoughts of what is next, that this is just a part of it. And there, like I said, there's a museum and there's a great exhibit going on of one of the great illustrators and animators that worked for Disney, his work, and not only his stuff for Disney, but also his paintings through the years.
Yeah.
So it was cool stuff. But there's so much art there and architecture that's interesting, even if it's phony. Even if it claims to be authentic and is phony. And, of course, it's wonderful touring and seeing, wow, there's George and Gracie, there's Nat King Cole, there's Jimmy Stewart. You know, here's this replica of the Wee Kirk of the Heather from Scotland. The original church, the original church hasn't existed for 200 years, but it exists here in Forest Lawn, and that's where Reagan and Jane Wyman were married. So it's an interesting history tour. It's an interesting art tour, architecture tour. But it's also, like I said, interesting in terms of its influence on Disney. And
right.
Because there's the same kitsch factor and there's the same disconnect with reality, but it's almost the flip side of the coin to a Disneyland where I think we can say that what Uncle Walt wants is for you to suspend your disbelief in fantasy. That's what he wants. He wants you to come into your park and suspend your disbelief in fantasy. Whereas what the builder, as he calls himself, of Forest Lawn wanted was for you to suspend your belief in reality.
Wow. Let me put those two concepts together. So I'm suspending my belief in reality.
Which is not necessarily suspending disbelief in fantasy, right? He's saying, no, suspend your belief in the reality you know and accept that this over here might be reality.
Right. Huh. Well, that's fascinating. Of all my things, I've only been to Forest Lawn once and wasn't, I didn't tour the whole thing. I didn't get to see other grave sites. It was for a funeral for a friend. So I just popped in there really quick and then left.
We might need to do this. I mean, this is, you'd be fascinated by some of the stuff. And also all the artists who were there and who contributed, and the gigantic Jan Strika painting of the crucifixion, the largest painting ever done, which was feared lost after the St. Louis Exposition. But was recovered and restored during 40-something years by Forest Lawn. Anyway, we might want to do that at some point.
I think that's something that would be a fun podcast.
Wow,
hanging around Forest Lawn.
Wow, we graveside tours. So much promise to get to, and I don't know. Like, we're at this point where we've got to start cutting stuff out. But I think we ought to talk about a couple of movies then.
Right.
One that someone had written us about. But first, I need to know, did you ever see, because this feels like something that Dean Haglund would have loved, a comedy that I think, you know, we've been talking so much about overlooked movies. It started about overlooked science fiction movies, but we've been talking about just overlooked movies. Here's one that I believe is overlooked. I have so many books that are, you know, the greatest films by decades, and this film never appears in any list for the 1930s or great comedies or anything. And it's an amazing comedy. It was actually nominated for Best Picture, and I think it's forgotten. It's called Ruggles of Red Gap.
What? Never heard of this.
1935, Ruggles of Red Gap, directed by the great comedy director Leo McCarey. His editor on it would be Edward Dimitrik, who would go on to direct, among other things, so many great film noirs. But it starred Charles Laughton as a manservant. He is lost in a poker game by an earl played by the amazingly funny and dry Roland Young to a man from the west of the United States, Red Gap, Washington, played by the fantastic Charles Ruggles, No relation to the title character. The cast also includes Zazu Pitts, so it's a big fish out of water thing. But it ends up becoming the most kind of patriotic movie because
this
manservant falls in love with America, and Lawton himself ends up delivering the Gettysburg Address in the movie. And what I'm learning after seeing this movie is that there's entire generations of Americans through the 20th century who knew the Gettysburg Address because of Charles Lawton in this movie. It had been forgotten by 1935. The text of it had been forgotten. And he made sure it would not be forgotten first by this beloved movie and then by making it the climax of his touring one-man show for decades.
Wow.
But this movie's so funny.
I didn't know that was the title because I came in the middle of this movie or early on, but to see him as a fish out of water change this small town with his British ways and charming manner so that the rugged Wild West soon cottons to his ideas. It is really funny. When did you see it?
Lily had seen it years back. And when she saw that it was going to be on TCM, she made sure that I watched it because she's always thought that I should see it. And I went, well, I've never heard of it. And Charles Lawton, I mean, of course, great actor, had a huge career. So many movies he was in were so good. But his young comedic performance in this it's breathtaking. It's so funny. Yeah. This movie is so, so very funny.
And you wouldn't think that from Charles Lawton because he had done Hunchback of Notre Dame. He was Captain Bly. He had done Henry VIII.
I think that same year he'd already done Henry VIII. You're right. I think that same year was Mutiny on the Bounty, which this might have lost to for both Best Picture and Best Actor.
Right. So think of that career, that range that Charles Lawton had to do both the comedy and the drama in the same year.
Clark Gable and Claudette Colbert both buried at Forest Lawn Glendale. All right. So that was one of my discoveries. I went to the Los Angeles County Museum of Art. One of the things that they do are Tuesday matinees. They've been showing a Guillermo del Toro exhibit about the filmmaker's work, much like the Stanley Kubrick exhibit before it. And as part of that program, the Tuesday matinees have been showing the films that influenced Del Toro. So a lot of these are horror films, apropos of our top 10 horror film episode. And one movie I'd never caught was the Japanese horror film Kwaidan, which we would consider a compound word roughly translated into ghost story. And it's an anthology of four different ghost tales from the director Masaki Kobayashi, who was reteamed with his star from the Human Condition trilogy, Tetsuya Nakadai, who's one of my 10 favorite actors of all time, who I just learned is not only still alive, but still acting in theater, just played John Barrymore on stage. And I can't wait to try to get him to be in a little independent movie sometime here in America. But
that would be fantastic.
But Kwaidan, when it came out in 1964, was the most expensive Japanese film ever made. And what I loved about seeing this, specifically at County Museum of Art, is the movie's not scary the way that we think of modern horror films, right? It's haunting, as you would hope a ghost story would be, and it's moving, and it's so beautiful, right? I mean, imagine that. One of the most beautiful films you'll ever see is a horror film.
A horror movie,
But because of the way that ghost stories and horror is rooted in Japanese culture, and that's what makes it so much fun, not only to see it on the big screen at the Bing Theater, but also at a museum, because you really are immersing yourself in another culture when you're watching a movie like this. And I sometimes think, again, at a time when almost every movie is available to us, that makes almost every movie disposable, and you really ought to avail yourself as a viewer of the opportunity to watch a film, we're all going to watch movies the way we want to watch movies, and generally right. it's going to be whatever's most convenient to us. But if you really want to get the most out of something, maybe find a context in which you're going to be able to appreciate the most about that work. And I don't think I would have ever been giving as much attention to all the arts and crafts involved, but also to the cultural dynamics at play if I'd watched it even on a Criterion Collection Blu-ray, but in that museum setting, being surrounded by great works of art from so many cultures, I was open to that.
Right. How cool is that? And I think that's one of the great things that LACMA does, right? I mean, by always using that theater, because so many galleries have a, you know, theater lecture hall that often stays dark for so long. So I got to give my hats off for LACMA to always try to show movies there continually to keep the programming alive. I'm very happy about that.
I have another recommendation for anyone who was sorrowful about the death of Gene Wilder, who or especially like me, who was mourning not only the death of this great actor, but mourning the fact that he didn't leave us more performances over the last couple decades of his life. And the good news is there are some, I believe, undiscovered gems in his filmography.
Really?
And one of them is a movie called Quaxer Fortune Has a Cousin in the Bronx.
I love it already.
And this film,
I'm sold.
This film from 1970 actually got a Writers Guild of America award for best comedy screenplay, which means back then you didn't have to be a guild member in order to get nominated. Now you have to be a guild member to get nominated. But because it was right. an Irish film, an independent film from Ireland that Gene Wilder starred in, along with Margot Kidder, young
what?
Margot Kidder in 1970, so charming, so beautiful. And this was the first lead role Gene Wilder ever filmed. He had won an Oscar, a supporting actor, or been nominated for supporting actor for The Producers. He'd, of course, been in Bonnie and Clyde, but this was the first lead he would shoot. It would come out the same year as Start the Revolution Without Me, and it would come out the year before Willy Wonka. And it's set in Dublin. He plays a manure salesman. He can't really read or write, but just the most optimistic disposition. And it's such a great depiction of Dublin life, of working class life, and the character that he plays is so charming and so unique, and could never have been brought to life by anybody else.
Wow.
It's just the perfect example of a script that might not work in other hands, and you would dismiss as going, wow, that was a bad script. You get it in the right hands, and you have it performed by the right actor. Suddenly you appreciate, this is wonderful writing.
Isn't that something?
And it's so funny. It is so funny. Quaxer Fortune Has a Cousin in the Bronx from 1970. There is a DVD available. It is a shitty DVD. I don't even think it's letterboxed, but it's not 16:9, so you'll have bars at the top and the sides on it. It's one of the early DVD releases, and the other trailers on it are, for example, are of VHS to DVD transfers of really bad 1980s documentaries exploring the concept of ancient astronauts. Like, that's the kind of company that distributed this. But seek it out. If you're a Gene Wilder fan and you're sad to be without him, I swear to you, you will not be disappointed. This film is so funny and he is so brilliant in it.
I'm dying to see this.
So really we're out of time. I had promised to talk about Child 44, which was written to us. A couple of weeks ago, a listener wrote to us about Child 44, wanting our take, wondering if he's insane to have liked it when so many people have dismissed it. I found it. I watched it. I have comments about it. But my advice first and foremost to that listener is come in off the ledge And we'll talk about this movie. You're not alone, and you should not feel bad about yourself for loving the movie. And
right.
I will both talk about what's fascinating about it, what's to recommend the movie, and also my explanation of why most people, I think, have dismissed the movie.
Right.
Because it is a movie where the flaws are somewhat obvious. But let's face it, sometimes we love works of art in spite of their flaws, and sometimes we love them because of their flaws. And if they are artists at work whose work really inspire and instruct us, again, their mistakes are sometimes really important to us because they both help illuminate the strengths of other works, but they also help teach us something. An interesting film, and I can't wait to talk about it, and we'll talk about it next week, Dean Hagman.
Awesome. I can't wait to see it.
That brings us to, well, maybe you will see it during the week, Child 44.
Maybe I'm going to
try to find it. It's available on demand in different places. Okay.
I know.
Brings us to an end of another exciting, we hope, very odd, installment of your Chilpack Hollywood Hour. People can find every episode we've ever done at chillpackhollywood.com, C-H-I-L-L-P-A-K, hollywood.com. Download them, stream them, subscribe via iTunes.
Write a review you want.
Well, what could be more fun? Why wouldn't they want to? Like us on Facebook, won't you?
Please like us.
Yes. Facebook.com.
We're at facebook.com/chillpackhollywood.
Yeah, when you're not too busy.
What else?
You know, liking things or poking things or like us. What about Twitter, like, Dean Hagland?
Well, you can follow us at Dean and Phil. Spell out the word and. And while you're at it, do the same thing at Instagram, because we're there and you are the king of the hashtags.
Hashtag, we give good hashtags. And is there anything else? We got to thank our hosts at Blog Talk Radio. And I don't know. What the hell else do we have to push? I don't think. Oh, write us. Write us. Why don't
you? Yes, you can write us.
Chilpack
like
Hollywood.
Like everyone does.
ChillpackHollywood@yahoo.com. Until next week, I'm Phil Lernis.
I'm Dean Hagland. See you then.
Belated spoiler alert.